Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. With me is In Context military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Good day, everyone.
In today's program, we're going to discuss insurgency warfare, a form of warfare that has become very common in the modern era. Why are some insurgencies successful while others are suppressed? We'll answer that question by looking closely at some examples of insurgency warfare. And once we have a basic understanding of insurgencies, we'll consider how the United States, if invaded, might fight an insurgent war against foreign occupiers. Marchand, before we get into specific insurgencies, let's start with a working definition of insurgency and then explore some general principles that apply to this form of war. So, to begin, how would you define an insurgency, and how does it differ from other forms of warfare?
Insurgency differs in that it is the use of guerrilla warfare. The word guerrilla warfare stems from the Napoleonic Wars. That's when we first see the usage of the word guerrilla. It means little war in Spanish, guerrilla war. It was basically coined by Spanish guerrillas, Spanish soldiers and volunteers who went and harassed the French, and they also harassed the British, and they launched harassing attacks on their enemy. They wouldn't meet them in the open fields. So it was what you call asymmetric warfare. It's not linear. It's not
asymmetric.
Asymmetric, exactly. It's not fought on a plain battlefield, on a linear battlefield, two armies facing each other. It's asymmetric. You're coming out of the hillside. You're coming out of the mountains. You're striking the enemy and they're running away. So that's guerrilla war. Insurgency is a type of guerrilla war. It's domestic. Insurgents, generally speaking, while they may be armed, while they may come from the outside, generally they're domestic. An insurgency can be funded by an outside force, like the conflict in Syria. The guerrillas that are fighting the Syrian government are an insurgency funded by the outside. They have a lot of foreigners fighting with them, but nominally it is a domestic movement as opposed to an invasion where a foreign army shows up and occupies a foreign land, attempts to take a piece of somebody else's territory.
What are some of the characteristics we could use to describe, to generalize about insurgent soldiers? Are they generally not fighting in uniforms, for example?
Generally speaking, no. They don't have to be not in uniform. They may very well be in uniform. When you look at the Viet Cong, for example, they were in uniform. There were a lot of North Vietnamese army that fought alongside them who were in uniform. So it doesn't necessarily mean they're out of uniform. Guerrilla warfare in of itself could be used by a conventional army as well as by peasant farmers. I mean, again, Vietnam being the prime example, you had the Viet Cong who were domestic communist insurgents in South Vietnam, and then you had the North Vietnamese army who were helping to wage the insurgency using guerrilla tactics. The tactics can vary too. The Viet Cong liked to meet the Americans on a battlefield. They would use guerrilla tactics and hammer them, and then they would launch an open attack. The IRA, for example, never meet the British army openly. They car bombs and things like that. But nonetheless, it's still an insurgency.
Yeah. Are insurgents generally not treated like prisoners of war, treated perhaps like criminals?
Yes, because they're not protected under the Geneva Convention. In order to be protected under the Geneva Convention, you have to be fighting in uniform, you have to have a rank structure, and you have to carry arms openly. Let's say, for example, the North Vietnamese army, even if they were using guerrilla tactics, when they were captured, they were soldiers. So long as they were in uniform, they had a rank structure, and they carried arms openly. The IRA, they don't wear uniforms, they don't carry arms openly, and they do have a rank structure, but the fact is that they're launching attacks not in uniform. Once you take off your uniform and you start launching attacks, you lose protection from the Geneva Convention and therefore become a criminal, under the Geneva Convention, an illegal combatant.
A regular soldier, if he decides, I want to go home, he can't do that. That would be desertion. He could be caught and shot. Can an insurgent just go home at night and go in, say, blend in with the village or go back to his family?
It really depends because if you enter that point where he's going back, where he launches an attack in uniform and then he goes back to a village and takes off his uniform, then you're starting to get into that nebulous area of whether you can be protected by the Geneva Convention or not. Certainly you do have guerrillas who do that. Insurgents, I should say, who do that. In other cases, you have insurgents who never wear uniforms but go back to their village at night.
I can imagine some of the IRA insurgents that you mentioned might even go back to their job the next day.
Oh, absolutely.
And just blend into the woodwork.
And that's what makes it complicated in terms of the issue of soldiers versus terrorists. The insurgents, again, in Northern Ireland, aren't wearing uniforms. They'll go and blow something up, not obviously not in uniform. Then they'll go home, go back to work the next day like nothing happened. Then they get arrested and they say, well, I'm a soldier. Well, you know, buddy, technically you're not. You talk about the Chinese People's Liberation Army, which waged a guerrilla war, an insurgency against the Kuomintang, the nationalist government of China. They wore uniforms. Now, some of them did go home at the end of the day, but they wore uniforms. They had a rank structure. They were based in their local communities, but they farmed the fields, but they didn't necessarily just casually go back to work after blowing up a few nationalist soldiers. And that really adds to a insurgency's credibility amongst its local population. If you are so confident that you are bearing arms openly, that you are in uniform openly, that even though you might be a volunteer, you might not be getting paid for it, but you're a volunteer, maybe you go work in the field or go work your job. The fact is, though, is that you're wearing your uniform openly demonstrates to the public confidence, the fact that we are in total full spectrum control over this area and we are a legitimate army. And that's what helped win the People's Liberation Army in China and the North Vietnamese Army, confidence of the locals. Now, the North Vietnamese Army, especially, the Viet Cong could be very brutal, but the North Vietnamese Army won confidence because they said, you know, we are a conventional, legitimate army. We're using insurgent tactics. We're using guerrilla tactics, but we are a conventional army. The reason why the IRA in Northern Ireland has lost a lot of credibility amongst the nationalist community is because they aren't confident in that they control their territory. They aren't confident in the fact that they can demonstrate themselves as a legitimate army. Instead, they feel the need to, again, don civilian clothes and try to blend in. Well, to the locals, that demonstrates weakness. During the Troubles, during the height of the Troubles, in some areas, the IRA carried their arms openly. They wore uniforms openly. And that's when people really had confidence in them because they said, wow, you know, these people are in full spectrum control. They're an army. If you come out onto the field and you look like a complete schlemiel, I mean, a complete slob. You know, you're walking out there, you're carrying your weapon like you don't know what you're doing. You dress like a civilian. It's going to cause people to think, well, what chance do these people have against the British Army? But whereas when you come out there and you are properly uniformed, you are well-trained in your weapon, you have manners. I mean, when you read Mao's handbook on guerrilla warfare, being polite and being professional is paramount. In fact, that's the first chapter. That's the first thing he talks about is being professional, paying for what you use, never entering somebody's home without permission. You know, things like that demonstrate to the public that you are a professional army capable of taking on the other professional armies.
Well, let's see how we can develop these general principles of insurgency warfare to a particular case. And an excellent example of the modern insurgency war can be seen in the Boer War, which took place in South Africa from 1899 to 1902. So, Marchand, could you give us a little background on the origin of the Boer War?
The Boers themselves are a fascinating people. The word Boer means farmer in Afrikaans, which is the language of the Afrikaner people, the descendants of the Dutch and Germans in South Africa. They first came to South Africa in the 17th century. They were predominantly traders with the Dutch East India Company, the rival to the British East India Company. Cape Town was originally meant to just be basically a resupply point. It wasn't meant to be a colony. Cape Town was just meant to be a stopping off point. The farmers, who at the time were known as burghers or Dutchmen, they were not called Afrikaners. They started to farm. They started to farm, and they started to get tired of the fact that they had to pay an obscene amount to the Dutch East India Company. They had to sell their crops for less than it was worth to the Dutch East India Company to resupply the ships. So these guys in the end decided, forget you guys. You know, we're going to do our own thing and begin to set up their own colony. And a lot of people came from Holland, from Germany, and later on you had a lot of English, a lot of Irish. People are surprised, but a lot of the original settlers of South Africa, aside from being Dutch, Calvinists, and Germans, there were a lot of Irish, later on Australians, New Zealanders, who came for job opportunities, and the colony boomed. And what you began to develop is a unique language, Afrikaans, which Afrikaans is a hybrid of English, Dutch, and German.
So it was basically, they were the center of gravity, there were farmers?
They were farmers. Although urban centers began to develop because a lot of the people arriving weren't all farmers. It began as a farming colony, but you had a lot of cities began to develop. You had, you know, Cape Town really became a burgeoning urban center. You know, later on you have Johannesburg, Pretoria, urban centers. So they had a very urban side to them. They weren't just peasant farmers showing up. One of the first things they began to construct were cities. And that's also where you began to see a split, because as the British bought Cape Town from the Dutch.
So the British come in, just to put it in perspective, around 1795. They take over Cape Town and they annex it in 1806. So the Boers have been there for 150 years at this point.
Exactly. And at this point, you also, like I say, seem to get a distinct language developing. Now, the word Afrikaner we don't see emerge until the late 18th century is when, late 19th century is when you begin to see the use of the word Afrikaner to describe the Europeans, not just the Afrikaans speakers, but the Europeans of South Africa who begin to assimilate into the Afrikaner language. That's where you really begin to see cemented a unique, globally unique identity. When Britain annexes Cape Town, you begin to see a lot of the Dutch population, a lot of the, like I say, the burghers decide, well, we don't want to pay taxes to the British. So you have the Great Trek into the interior.
Okay, so the British at this point are into controlling Cape Town because it's a very important stopping point on a route to its colonies further east, like India and Australia.
Which is why the Dutch wanted it to begin with. It was the quickest route, because you've got to remember the Suez Canal hasn't been built yet.
Right, so you've got to go around the southern tip of Africa if you want to go to, say, to Australia or to India. And at this point, then the Boers start moving out. They start moving away from the coast.
Yes, not all of them, but many of them. The Boers in particular, the farmers. Again, like I say, Boer means farmer, but that didn't imply all Afrikaners were necessarily farmers. A lot stayed in Cape Town, a lot stayed in the cities. But these initial Boers, initial farmers, went out and made what's known as the Great Trek. They're called the Voer Trekkers. They travel into the interior and they begin
this
setting
up farms.
This
is the early 1800s.
Yes.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context's website is incontextreport.com. And you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about insurgency warfare. We're looking at what makes some insurgencies successful while others are suppressed. And we're going to see how the United States, if invaded, might fight an insurgency war against foreign occupiers.
Now, it's important to note that from very early on, the peoples of South Africa, the indigenous peoples, the African tribes, the Xhosa, the Khoikhoi, the Zulus, who we see emerge later on in the 19th century, were very warlike in of themselves. They could be compared to the Afghans. They were very sophisticated cultures, but they were very warlike. They fought each other all the time. They had their own empires. You know, the notion that the Boers first displaced the Africans is a little bit of propaganda. In reality, what happened is the Boers move up, they settle, and now they are the proverbial new kid on the block, and they're starting to push into the existing African empires. So just like you would have happen on the global scene, you know, when you think about World War I, Germany becomes united and the other world empires start getting a little annoyed at this new kid on the block. It's the same thing with the Boers. So the African tribes start fighting the Boers. So you see the Boers begin to develop themselves from a commercial people into a very hardy, warlike people themselves. Warfare becomes a part of existence for them because there were several famous massacres where the indigenous people went in and they slaughtered all the women and children. So for the Boers, survival meant fighting. There wasn't a chance to
negotiate. So it was a way of life. Fighting was a way of life, even though they didn't have a big standing army.
They had no standing army. Fundamentally, because the Dutch East India Company at this point had left. So the army of the Dutch East India Company no longer existed.
So the Boers were on their own
themselves. And they became the epitome of the citizen soldier. You'd go plow your field one day, and then, you know, the Xhosa or the Zulus or the Khoikhoi would show up, and your only choice was to, you know, you had to pick up a gun and fight, or they'd burn your farm. And so everybody came together and fought.
Well, now the British came to South Africa originally to get Cape Town to have this convenient port. Two events happened in South Africa in the later part of the 19th century, which are very significant regarding the coming Boer War. One is 1867, diamonds are discovered in South Africa.
Kimberley.
And then in 1884, gold is discovered. What do these discoveries have to do with the Boer War?
Well, first of all, the diamonds being discovered at Kimberley was huge because it was the largest diamond mine in the world. I mean, Kimberley's been mined dry at this point, but it was the largest diamond mine in the world. For the British to control the diamond trade was huge, you know, because all the royalty of Europe wanted diamonds. So that's when you see the Anglo-Zulu War, which is significant because the Zulus were the strongest military tribe. I mean, they were the ultimate military state.
This is what,
the
late 1870s?
1879.
About 20 years before the Boer War breaks out.
Exactly, 1879. And with Disraeli in Parliament, Disraeli saying, let's go. We have to annex Natal, which was the Zulu land, and we have to start pushing into the interior, especially with the finding of diamonds in Kimberley.
So Natal became the British colony in South Africa?
Exactly. Well, after the Anglo-Zulu War, when the British just devastated, I mean, they decimated the Zulus.
So if we get to the setting just before the Boer War begins, you have this British colony in Natal is next to the Boer entities. What are they called?
The Transvaal Republic and the Orange Free State. Now, they developed a unique relationship with Britain in that they were nominally, in some ways, subservient to Britain, but they had autonomy. They could govern their own affairs, but they did have to sort of give military deference to Britain. They were nominally independent, but at the same time, they kind of gave way a little bit to Britain. It was an awkward relationship, if you will.
But it does move towards war in 1899. It seems like both sides saw it coming, and the British started to bulk up on their troop presence.
Both the Transvaal Republic and the Orange Free State were pledged to neutrality. They wanted to be left alone. You know, when gold was discovered and the Transvaal and the Orange Free State went from being like producing less than 1% of the world's gold to producing almost all of it. It's important to remember that suddenly the Transvaal and the Orange Free State become incredibly wealthy. And that's when Britain takes a very big interest in the Orange Free State, in the Transvaal Republic.
So the Brits raid into the Boer Republic.
In an attempt to overthrow Paul Kruger,
yes,
who's the president of the Transvaal. When that fails, that's when you then see the Boers launch an attack on the British.
And the war really starts out as a conventional war, doesn't it? Could you talk about the Battle of Ladysmith, for example, and the ensuing siege?
The Battle of Ladysmith was very humiliating for the British in many ways because you had a large, large British force that ended up getting surrounded after they attempt to break out. And they end up getting surrounded by the Boers, by the Boer army, and this long siege ensues. And there were several sieges that took place. You know, there's the siege of the British army at a British force at Kimberley, the British force at Ladysmith, Ladysmith being the most prominent. But you also had sieges going on at places like
Magersfontein. So basically, the Boers were strong enough at the outset of the war to really wage what we would consider a conventional siege warfare surrounding the British garrisons in South Africa?
Absolutely. But at the same time, they waged a guerrilla war. What's interesting is the Boers had what were called commando units, which is where we get our modern word commando from. We associate it with World War II, with the British commandos. But no, it began with the Boers. These Boer commandos, namely under the command of a man named Couste de la Raye, who's considered the greatest Boer general to have ever lived, he fought the British at battles like Colenso.
This was a great British defeat that occurred in December of 1899, shortly after the war began.
Yes, exactly. But at battles like Colenso, Magersfontein, and at Spion Kop, the Boers knew they didn't have the heavy artillery the British did. That was really the great equalizer for the British, was they had heavy artillery. Well, the Boers realized they didn't have the heavy artillery or the numbers, but they had better marksmanship. The British did not train in marksmanship as well. They didn't put as much of an emphasis on it. The Boers trained very heavily as riflemen because they had to hunt. They also spent years and years fighting the Zulus and fighting the Xhosa and fighting all these other tribes. So what they did at Colenso, at Spion Kop, at Magersfontein, is they outmaneuvered the British. They took the high ground. And then when the British would come marching up the hill, they would just rain down an unbelievable volume of accurate rifle fire on the British and just devastate them. You can find photographs of Spion Kop after the battle. And in existence today, these are some of the earliest war photos. The entire British force is just literally laid out in a valley.
Well, why didn't the Boers then finish off the British? Why did the war develop very quickly into a guerrilla, an insurgency war?
Ultimately, you had one army that was too powerful to launch a successful offense against. You could defend against them, but the Boers didn't have the numbers or the firepower to ultimately push the British back. There were attempts to invade British-occupied South Africa. There were even attempts to launch domestic insurgencies in places like Cape Town. But the Afrikaner population in places like Cape Town just were not interested in taking on the British Empire.
And the British were putting more and more troops in as the war progressed.
That was the biggest problem. And they went through generals like it was nobody's business. Lord Kitchener, who we famously associate with World War I, was a veteran of the Boer War, one of the famous commanders that they cycled through. And then, of course, Redvers Buller, who was a veteran of the Zulu War, who famously survived the British massacre at Isandlwana, where the entire British army was wiped out with the exception of a handful. He was one of the commanders they cycled through. White was another commander. They kept cycling through commanders because they kept running into these humiliating defeats. But no matter what happened, the British couldn't exhaust their supply of manpower, whereas the Boers were getting exhausted.
So they switch tactics and they move into what I guess we would call more of a classic insurgency warfare campaign, guerrilla campaign. Let's talk about the tactics that they used. How successful were they?
Well, they were very successful. They rode on horseback and they rode across what they call the veldt. The veldt, the plains, the steppes, if you will, the steppes of South Africa. You know, we kind of think of the steppes of Eastern Europe. The veldt was like the steppes of
good horse
South
country.
Africa. Great horse country. They were very highly mobile. They would ride in, blow up rail lines. They would ride in and ambush trains. They would ambush supply convoys.
A lot of hit and run tactic.
Exactly. Ambush British troops. They were very successful as guerrilla units. So the British introduced for the first time concentration camps. We think of concentration camps, we think of World War II. It wasn't. It was originated during the Boer War for reasons of displacing the rebels. And this is really the only way you win an insurgency. You have to separate the guerrillas from the locals. In a place like an urban center, the way you separate the guerrillas from the locals is you just flood the place with troops so that the guerrillas can't maneuver. In a place like South Africa, it's just too wide and spread out to separate, to have ever enough troops to separate the guerrillas from the local citizenry. So what the British did is they went in, they would burn the farms, then they would take the Boers off the farms, and they would imprison them basically in these concentration camps.
It's kind of scorched earth policy. You destroy their supplies by burning their farms, and then you physically remove the civilian population from the farms and you put them what they called concentration camps.
The British intention was not to starve the Boers to death and wipe them out. It was to starve the guerrillas. The problem that the British ran into is the concentration camps initially were not that bad. They had housing, they had food. Problem was nobody wants to be removed from their home and have their home burned. I'm not justifying the concentration camps. What I'm trying to say is these weren't like the Nazi concentration camps, which were concentration camps for the purpose of slave labor. The problem the British ran into is they ended up with more internees than they could handle. And people ended up starving to death because the British didn't have enough food. They didn't know what to do with all these people that they now had rounded up. They really didn't think of that far through.
But just to put it in the context, it's estimated that 26,000 Afrikaner women and children died of disease and malnutrition in the concentration camps. And if you translated that to a country of the present size of the United States, around 300 million, we're talking about over 5 million civilian women and children killed in these concentration camps through disease and malnutrition. So it was a pretty horrific experience for the country.
Oh, it was. The condition for the Boers improved in the concentration camps because, and this is the first time we see the power of petitioning, but women traveled to South Africa, saw the condition of these Boer farmers in the concentration camps, and they actually raised money.
Yeah, so it was causing the women and children. It was causing a severe reaction back at home. And that brings us to the key point of a popular support for an insurgency. Did the Boers have a widespread popular support at home?
At home, yeah, in South Africa, they did. Yes. That's the reason why the British interned all of the Boer population.
So a key thing for an insurgency is to have a general population behind you so you can get from them what, not just volunteers, but supplies, places, I suppose, to hide.
But that's why the first thing the British did is they immediately tried to remove the Boer guerrillas from the Boer population.
And the guerrillas themselves, now, as I understand, they were pretty well organized. They were in these commando units.
And they enjoyed some popular support. There were about 3,000 and Irishmen alone who fought for the Boers.
They had foreign support.
Foreign support, yeah. You had about 3,000 Irishmen who fought for the Boers and later settled in South Africa, which is why you see so many people with Irish names in South Africa. 3,000 Irishmen fought. You had thousands of Australians, thousands of Americans. Lots and lots of people from outside came and joined the Boers. And some of these were the bitter enders, you know, people who fought to the very end alongside the Boers were these foreigners.
Well, one of the items that's important in insurgency is the ability to protect population. The insurgents can protect the population so that people have confidence in them, feel that they're in control. Was the concentration camp policy of the British designed to break that ability to protect and control the population?
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, it was such a horrific tactic, because because what the British did is they walked in there and they burned the farms and they moved the populace. So, you know, you had a family, the husband's off with the guerrillas, and the British army shows up, burns the farm, and takes them all off to a concentration camp. And a lot of these guerrillas had their wives and children die in the concentration camps.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context website is incontextreport.com. And you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe about insurgency warfare. We're looking at what makes some insurgencies successful while others are suppressed. And we're going to see how the United States, if invaded, might fight an insurgency war against foreign occupiers. So we can look at the pluses on the side of the Boer insurgents. You've got, they were well-trained. They were hardy men who had a lot of experience fighting the native Africans. They were farmers. They were self-sufficient type people. They enjoyed a widespread popular support. They also, as you pointed out, had foreign assistance on their side, foreign volunteers.
But one thing I also want to add to that list, though, that, which is very important, is that the Boers also had the moral right. There was no question in the eyes of the populace, and indeed the eyes of the international community, that the Boers were right. The Boers were right to be fighting the British. They were fighting for their freedom.
But no foreign government actually came to their aid.
No, but you don't necessarily need a foreign government. You see, having the moral right gives your people, your fighters, the confidence to keep fighting. And that's something that's psychologically very, very, very important for an army. When your soldiers know that what they're fighting for is right, they will fight to the bitter end. If they had surrendered and submitted to British rule, the war would have ended a lot more quickly. But the fact is that they knew they were fighting for their independence.
Well, now let's look at the British side. Okay, what have they got for them? It seems like one of the main things is numerical superiority, right?
Yes, they have numerical superiority. They have technological superiority, and
they've got the heavy artillery.
Yeah,
they have machine guns. So in a set-piece battle, they're going to win.
Yeah, you have machine guns, you have heavy artillery. They also commanded a very large economy. They had the money to spend on it.
Combining all these advantages with their concentration camp policy, with their scorched earth policy, really was what led them ultimately to prevail?
Well, and sad but true, the policy of the horrific conditions in the concentration camps also broke down a lot of the Boers because they saw their wives and children dying in the concentration camps, and that just broke their spirit for a lot of them. You did have the bitter enders, those who kept on fighting through the winters, sleeping out on the veldt because they had nowhere else to go. They were able to sustain the insurgency for as long as they did because they believed they were right. The Boers kept on fighting when most armies would have broken.
Well, now in 1902, the Boers do surrender. But 8 years later, in 1910, the Boer republics are actually incorporated into a Union of South Africa. And I'm wondering, did they actually, in the long run, lose? Because don't they end up with self-government in a country in which they're going to end up being the majority population? I mean, amongst the European settlers.
No, absolutely. In fact, actually, that's the irony of it, is the Boers ultimately won. And even to this day, you know, with the end of apartheid and everything, one of the things that I find fascinating studying South Africa is, unlike Rhodesia, where you had majority rule and the whites pretty much were exterminated, somewhere like South Africa, the Afrikaner culture is surviving very strong. And especially now into the 2000s, I was looking at the police force for South Africa. And in places like Pretoria, the police chief is an Afrikaner. You look at Rhodes College in Grahamstown, South Africa, and the 50% of the graduate students are Afrikaners. 44% of the undergrads are Afrikaners. Right now, they're 10% of the population, but they're still culturally surviving and thriving. So ultimately, one could say is that they were the ultimate winners of the Boer War.
Before we leave the Boer War, is there anything that the Boers could have done that actually won a military victory in the situation? Or was it hopeless once the British resorted to the concentration camps and the scorched earth policy?
It really became hopeless once the British resorted to the scorched earth policy. It, you know, it's the tragedy of it is that the people who paid the greatest price were ultimately the civilians. And that's where you see the evolution of modern war being waged against civilians. Well, that's what everybody has been doing ever since the Boer War.
Well, Marshawn, let's leave the Boer War and turn to a more recent example of insurgency warfare, and that's the United States war in Afghanistan. Now, the United States invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001. The U.S. quickly captured the country's capital, Kabul, and installed a new pro-American government, that would be Hamid Karzai. But that quick victory soon turned into a very difficult and protracted war against Afghan insurgents. Why, after so many years of fighting, has the U.S. been unable to defeat the Afghan insurgency?
Well, part of that is because the Afghans have somewhere to go. We go into the country, we flatten the Taliban strongholds. We, you know, come in with a lot of troops and we say, you know, we control the country. Well, the first thing the Taliban did is they fled into Pakistan.
Well, let's talk about the Taliban fighter, the typical Afghan insurgent. What kind of background does he come from? Is he a town city dweller? Is he a country person? Does he have a familiarity with firearms? Does he have experience fighting?
They're typically country folk. They typically have a lot of experience fighting. They've been fighting each other. When they're not fighting an outsider, they're fighting each other. Winston Churchill famously said in Afghanistan, every man's hand is against the other and all against the outsider. So since they were children, they've been fighting. A typical Afghan farmer has fought in a battle when he was, by the time he's 12. They have a tremendous amount of experience, like the Boers. But the difference is, though, is that when we invaded, the first thing the Taliban fighters did, the leadership did, is they went into Pakistan. They fled into Pakistan where they knew we weren't going to chase them. And they did the same thing when the Soviets invaded. The Soviets had a scorched earth policy, but it didn't matter because that was not the base of Taliban support.
This is the 1980s.
This is the 1980s. The base of Taliban support was in Pakistan. So unlike the Boers who had to resupply on their own farms, the Taliban was resupplying in Pakistan where the scorched earth policy couldn't extend. When the Afghans were fighting the Soviets, they were getting a tremendous amount of material help from the Americans. Nowadays, the Taliban gets a tremendous amount of material help from the Russians and from the Chinese.
The Afghans have a pretty good track record of resisting, of fighting successful insurgencies, going back to Alexander the Great, who was just happy to get out of the country. His army was almost completely destroyed. He passed through on his way to India. But more recently, the British fought three unsuccessful wars against the Afghans, two big ones in the 19th century. Can you talk about the British experience?
Well, the British experience was disastrous. The first invasion was in the mid-19th century, and the British army was annihilated outside Kabul on its march back to Jalalabad. Dr. William Bryden, who later on wrote about it, was the only survivor. Then after that, you had a second British invasion. Well, you had another one, you know, the army retribution came back, but it's still considered part of the first Anglo-Afghan War, went in, burned Kabul, and left. Then you had a second invasion, which actually was pretty successful, but the difference was the British didn't decide to stay. They marched in. They kicked the emir around. They kicked the Afghans around. They fought some big battles. They lost a couple battles, and then they left. And then the third Afghan war was the most successful because they just bombed the heck out of the Afghans from the air and then left. The key to British success in Afghanistan and British failure was that they chose not to stay. When they chose to stay, they got wiped out. When they chose not to stay, they were left alone.
One important attribute of a successful insurgency is the ability to protect the population. I guess if you're the occupier, you want to convince the civilians that you represent law and order and safety. And if you're the insurgents, you want to convince the population that they're very safe in any area you control. Well, how has that played out in Afghanistan?
Well, what you're seeing now, and this follows in with Mao's principles of guerrilla warfare, what you're seeing as we have the troop drawdown and we're handing the country over to the quote-unquote Afghan national forces, it's absolute malarkey. What's happening is the Afghan security forces are basically handing the country over to the Taliban because they have no interest in dying for Karzai. It's also they belong to these tribes, the same tribes the Taliban do. And the Taliban march into a village in the same way the Viet Cong did. And they say, look, you either work for us or we kill you. And the villagers are saying, well, you know, I can work for the Americans, have my family killed, or I can work for the Afghans and get left alone. And that's pretty much it. We can't provide security for the populace. And now that we're having the troop drawdown, the average Afghan soldier is saying to himself, I could support the Americans and watch my family get killed, or I could support the Taliban and get left alone. So when we hand a region over the Afghan National Army, they pretty much sign a deal with the Taliban, say, look, we'll stay out of your way, you stay out of ours, and the Taliban go, fair enough.
How was the U.S. tactic of using drone aircraft to kill people? How is that affecting popular sentiment, do you think?
It is probably the most boneheaded thing President Obama and indeed President Bush could do. But President Obama, who's expanded the drone strikes, it is the singular most boneheaded thing he could do. Because every time we launch a drone strike and we blow up women and children, the Taliban show them on the internet and TV. It's the Taliban aren't stupid. They have computers. They show it on the internet and television. They say, Americans killed babies. They hand out pictures of dead children that were blown up in drone strikes. And all it does is tick off the local population and give them more of a reason to support the Taliban.
How about now the element of geography? It's a mountainous country, a rural country. Most of the insurgents are, farmers who are familiar with the terrain. How does that affect the ability of the United States to conduct a successful counterinsurgency? And also, how about the inaccessibility of many places due to the lack of modern highways?
Well, that's part of the problem. There are virtually no modern roads. There's one highway, one major highway that runs in a giant loop through the country, and that's it. Literally, it's a giant circle, and that's it. There are very few roads, so to speak of, with the exception of a few mud and dirt paths, which make it almost inaccessible for American heavy armored vehicles. Now, one of the things the U.S. did in Iraq was, because Iraq was flat and very modern, the U.S. developed a lot of very heavy vehicles. And I saw General O'Donnell speaking recently at the Brookings Institute, and he said one of the problems is that the U.S. Army in particular, but the U.S. military as a whole, has lost its mobility. In Iraq, we learned to develop very heavy armored vehicles to resist IEDs. But now in Afghanistan, that's preventing us from projecting our influence anywhere because these vehicles are too heavy for the Afghan dirt roads and they'll sink or fall off a cliff. Very, very, very dangerous.
The Afghan insurgents seem to have many of the qualities on their side of the Boers. The Boers were not successful in ultimately militarily defeating the British. They had to surrender in 1902. Could the U.S. hope for an outcome like that in Afghanistan? If not, where does the war go?
You would have to deploy a million American soldiers to Afghanistan. You'd have to prosecute the war into Pakistan, and you'd have to wage a total war against the Taliban. You either support us or we bomb your village. It's brutal. And I'm not saying I agree with that tactic. That would be the only way you could really prosecute a war against guerrillas.
We're talking 10 times more troops than we have there now.
Easy, easy.
So where do the Afghans, assuming we maintain a relatively low level of troops, and we withdraw even those troops, what happens to the insurgents movement? Does it become bolder? Does it start to take over cities? What's the next step?
Well, that's the next step. And these groups are adhering to Mao's principles of guerrilla warfare, which are, you know, to secure for yourself a safe haven, training camps, begin attacking enemy outposts, launching guerrilla strikes, controlling the countryside, and then attacking the cities with conventional forces. The next step for the Taliban, as we surrender control of the major cities, will be to start surrounding and attacking the U.S. forces in places like Bagram, Kandahar, Kabul, Mazar Sharif, surrounding the U.S. forces and shelling them. Because the fact is that if we have 30,000 troops there, how many of those are artillery and combat aircraft pilots? How many of them are going to be supply, maintenance, medical staff? Most of them are not going to be combat troops. So this means that and with control of the countryside, this means that they'll be able to move in things like artillery, which there's no shortage of because they're getting it from the Afghan government.
You mean the insurgents will be able to move in?
That's what I mean. The insurgents are stealing it from the Afghan army or getting it handed to them by the Afghan army or the Pakistanis.
One of Mao's tactics, which was to take arms from the enemy, in this case, the nationalists, and that way thereby equip his own army.
Exactly. And he's getting it from the Pakistanis and the Russians and the Chinese. We're dealing with them as though we're on equal terms. But the Afghans know if we deployed a million men and, launched a massive offensive, we'd have thousands of casualties, but launched a massive offensive, then you'd see the Taliban might be willing to come to the negotiating table. But now, this is kind of like the Germans trying to negotiate as Berlin is falling.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context website is incontextreport.com. And you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about insurgency warfare. We're looking at what makes some insurgencies successful while others are suppressed. And we're going to see how the United States, if invaded, might fight an insurgency war against foreign occupiers. Okay, well now the Boer War, the Afghan War, Iraq War, some of the other insurgencies that we mentioned, illustrate some of the important principles of insurgency warfare. let's talk about a hypothetical to see how these principles might be applied at home. And let's assume for the sake of our discussion that the United States were invaded by a foreign country, let's say the Russians or the Chinese, and that the Americans had to fight a war of insurgency against these occupiers. Let's talk about some of the important characteristics of the U.S. population that would bear on our capacity, on the U.S. capacity to conduct an insurgency warfare. What kind of society we have? I mean, we're talking urban versus rural. How does our setup socially in America prepare us for an insurgency warfare?
The problem is right now we're very poorly prepared. As much as we might like to think it, we're not a very tough society. You know, you do have some areas like Detroit and stuff, which are very gang-ridden, very crime-ridden, but we're not as a whole a very rugged society, should I say. I actually heard one person say to me, if we were ever invaded, every gang member, every Blood and Crip would be out there throwing Molotov cocktails. Well, that's all well and good. They'll get gunned down within the first 5 seconds and it'll end. The only kind of insurgency that's proven to work is when the populace is organized, when they are rugged, meaning they're willing to put up with the privations. Because let's not make any mistake. If we were invaded by somebody like the Russians or the Chinese, they are not afraid to set up concentration camps.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say that the average American youth has not been engaged in fighting like the typical Afghan youth. And I think it's also fair to say that we're an urban / suburban society predominantly. How does that relate to insurgency? Are these type of people who live in situations of that like that inclined to be insurgent fighters?
They might. If you look at, for example, Northern Ireland, the question becomes, though, how much suffering will the people put up with? Because there's no doubt over the fact that when you wage a guerrilla war, there's going to be a tremendous amount of suffering. And how many people are willing to have their homes burned and keep on fighting? How many people are willing to watch their family members get executed and keep on fighting?
You know, if you were an invader, would you first try to capture the U.S. cities? Would that be the principle?
Absolutely. And then move inland along the highways, because most of the U.S. population is centered in the cities. Now, cities are perfect defense zones for a conventional army, but the principle of an insurgency would be that the conventional, in the U.S., would be that the conventional army has collapsed or has fallen back and you're in an occupied zone. The question becomes, how can the populace organize? In the U.S., our greatest asset are our veterans. And that would be the veterans, the gun owners, getting together at their local gun clubs and saying, listen, you know, we all know each other. We all know we own guns. Hey, Bob Johnson was in the infantry. Joe was a Green Beret, you know, this, that. And then coming together and organizing along those lines.
So the fact that we have something like 300 million guns in the United States isn't in itself constitute a good preparation for an insurgent war?
No, because, I mean, and my favorite example is Somalia. In Somalia, the Somalis were awash with guns. They did not have a lot of, I mean, they had a fair amount of experience fighting each other, but not a lot in 1993 when we invaded. Well, 1992 when we invaded. But the Battle of Mogadishu, the Somalis fired an unbelievable number of bullets. They outnumbered the U.S. forces 1,000 to 1, but they didn't wipe out the U.S. Rangers and Delta Force that they surrounded. Not because our guys had the greatest firepower, but rather because our guys were much better trained. The Somalis had virtually no actual training. Now, the flip side of that, or organization, they were not organized at all.
Well, the kind of organization you're talking about, say, in the United States, where you would have largely based upon veterans with some experience, would these be locally organized?
They would have to be locally organized. Most guerrilla units are locally, or most insurgencies are locally organized, because the backbone of the guerrillas are the populace. Now,
well, if you know, so, if one were to look at American culture, you'd have to say that unlike, say, Afghanistan, where it's a rural, a farming, a warrior culture, tribally based, we're ultimately a commercial culture. People are in America to make money. Our important relationships are often with our co-workers and our bosses. And that's kind of the frame of reference to which Americans operate.
And we also haven't been battle-tested in this way. The Afghans have been battle-tested like this. The Boers were battle-tested
What kind of training and equipment could you give, say, locally organized groups that would prepare them in some way for an insurgency war?
Well, I think if we had something like the Home Guard, I think that's a phenomenal model, like the British Home Guard during World War II. The idea of you have all these locals, you get them together, they're uniform, they're under the Ministry of Defense. In this case, they'd be under the Department of Defense. They receive a moderate military training, so they're familiarized with their weapons. They don't need to go to basic training and, you know, 10 weeks of training. They just need to be familiarized. They have a rank structure and they have uniforms. So this way, when the invader comes in, the invader sweeps through, these guys, A, could be the first line of defense, but also B, they would already be organized and have some background with their weapons so that this way they could launch a successful insurgency. Also, owning the weapons that they're issued would be crucial, because then this way, when the invasion comes, these guys can hide the weapons under their floorboards and then come out once the enemy has passed over them, the main enemy force, and begin launching hit-and-run attacks. The problem is, if you're not organized and you got Bob Johnson firing from his roof, the problem's going to be is it's one guy and they'll pick him off.
The professional army has training exercises where they carry out war battle plans, scenario that they think might happen. Would a local unit find it useful to also have exercises where they would rehearse what they might do in the event
of an invasion? Periodically, the British Home Guard would go to the local army base for training exercises where they would practice ambushing German troops, where they would practice identifying paratroopers. They usually had weekly drills or even nightly drills. Every night they get together at the height of the war, where they get together and they'd say, okay, tonight we're going to have an hour-long class on how to spot German paratroopers. And the idea was that, or how to make explosives. And the idea was that these guys would be, you know, they were locals, so it wasn't a schlep. You weren't driving 2 hours. You know, you would go down to your local church or your local town hall. You would have your hour-long...
These guys were volunteers?
Exactly. We're all volunteers. You'd have your hour-long briefing, you know, formation. Everybody gets in formation. You know, the captain walks out, right, men, this is what we're going to be doing. All right, carry on. And usually there were small elements. They were platoons, so you might have a lieutenant, not a captain. But the lieutenant would come out and say, this is the class we're going to give. It's going to be on explosives. So-and-so from the Ministry of Defense is here. He's going to teach us on how to blow up railways. And the idea was that this way, when the Germans invaded, the Home Guard could be the first line defense, but also they could make up the backbone of the insurgency. Because as long as you have people who are trained, then you can recruit.
What would be the objectives of an insurgency once an invasion happened? Let's say our regular army was defeated or had to surrender. What would be their objective? Would they try to defend cities? Would they try to defend highways or key transportation hubs? Or would they retreat to the countryside, in which case they would have a hard time, I suppose, being supplied? What would be their priority?
It entirely depends on where their base of support is, honestly. And that's something, because we've never experienced this before, I can't say. It could be you would have some insurgent groups that would be headquartered in the cities. A lot of it would be contingent on where the collaborators were. Let's say we took somewhere like L.A. The Chinese invade, and they say to the Latinos, you know what, you're going to be part of a new Latino People's Republic and this and that.
Right,
and that
sure. 60% occupier's tactic would be to split the population. The country, yeah.
I'm not knocking Latinos. I'm saying this would be what an invader's tactic would be, is split the population. So now you have a state that's 62% Hispanic. And they're now in a position of power. They're in a position where being collaborators is beneficial. And now you're the guerrilla. You won't be able to function in the cities because they'll basically inform upon you. So you might have to relocate to the countryside. Now flip that over, and let's say you have somewhere like New York, and you have areas like let's say Little Italy, where they are staunchly independent and they like the guerrillas. They might support the guerrillas. They might allow you to hide out in their restaurants or homes.
I suppose one of the important elements of planning and training individuals would be to mold a morale, a belief that we're going to defend our country, whether it's conventionally or in insurgent warfare. When an invasion happened, there would be no question about collaboration.
Exactly. Because if we all gathered around the, you know, liberty, democracy, whatever, and we gathered the whole population around a common cause, this is what we will stand for. Nobody will ever conquer us. Your chances of getting collaborators are much slimmer. The problem we have is that as a country, we are very disunited. It'll be very easy to split the disenfranchised from the majority.
Yes. One of the things you talked about is the importance of assuring the people that you could protect them. In that regard, it seems to me very important for your locally organized groups to prevent their towns and cities from being taken over. Because once they were taken over, you'd be cut off from your bases of fort. And also the people would now look to the occupiers if the occupiers behave properly. Well, as a source of safety?
Not necessarily, because like if you look at South Armagh during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, they kept
this
the British...
This is when in the 1960s? 70s?
In the 70s and 80s. They kept the British army out. Let's say the occupiers invade, they destroy your conventional army, they sweep over, but in, let's say, Greenwich, for example, you keep harassing the enemy force so that it makes it impractical for them to try to enforce their laws and their, you know, rule. You've now established security for the local populace. The problem is if all you do are committing a few car bombs and they go in and burn part of your town and shoot a whole bunch of your people, well, then you're clearly not providing
security.
Are
there certain advantages to an urban society that has an organized resistance with regard to urban warfare? Isn't urban warfare very costly for an occupier?
It is, but more so in a conventional war than in a guerrilla war. Because the problem with an urban setting, it all depends on how brutal the occupier wants to be. Because when you look at, like, the south of Ireland. During the War of Independence in 1918 to 1922, the guerrillas were predominantly located in the countryside, but as well in the cities. But they enjoyed so much popular support that the British had a very hard time pursuing them in places like Dublin. You know, but in places like Belfast, they had no popular support. So the British Army didn't have to worry about pursuing the IRA.
As I look at the Boer War in particular, and I see the success of the scorched earth policy, the concentration camp policy of the British, would it be likely that an invader in the United States would resort to such tactics?
Absolutely. That's the tactic now of modern-day counterinsurgencies. War today is waged against civilians. We're one of the few who fight semi-fair. If the Chinese or the Russians were to show up, they would make no bones about it, especially the Chinese. They fight total war. Look at every Chinese war since the end of World War II. What they do when they wage war, Tibet in particular, is genocide. Genocide's the first weapon of them for occupation.
So let's say that we cannot then afford to lose our cities. Perhaps the local units that we're talking about, these locally trained based units, with the core perhaps being your veterans, that their best use would be as an auxiliary to the regular army to make sure that cities are not captured, perhaps by providing not only physical defense, but a knowledge of the terrain and building in advanced fortifications, which make the cities very costly to take.
Absolutely. With the National Guard in Savant's books, is things like, well, if there's an invasion, what are we going to do? Where are we going to start digging trenches? Where are we going to start building bunkers? Do we have cement to build bunkers? Do we have enough shovels and sandbags? Do we have enough tank traps? You know, can we build enough tank traps?
Make it very, very costly for an invader to take your cities.
Exactly. The problem we have today is that we fundamentally are not prepared for an invasion. So if an invader were to show up and just start rolling tanks into New York or L.A., our National Guard might not even have the ammunition to resist. So, I know there are a lot of units where their ammunition is kept in separate states.
In addition to training, organizing local home guards, whatever you want to call them, it sounds like it's very important to educate the population generally about the danger and what they would do, what needs to be done in order to prevent their country from being taken over.
Exactly. That's what Britain did a lot of during World War II, the idea that we will keep resisting no matter what.
It sounds to me, as this conversation develops, is we the United States, in such an invasion scenario, has to be proactive, has to prevent the invader from taking key areas.
Especially when you're talking about somebody like the Russians or the Chinese.
Because we're not going to, the average urban, suburban dweller is not going to put a backpack on and go off to the mountains and fight, as in the movie Red Dawn. I don't see that happening with the American population.
No, Red Dawn was, and the new Red Dawn especially, were movies of fantasy. They really were. Well, A, those are country folks in Montana, places like Montana. In reality, places like Montana, the Russians and the Chinese in particular, would just sweep in, exterminate everybody in the village and say, good luck resisting. They would use the British tactic of concentration camps. They would use the British tactic of burning all the farms. You know, and that's one thing that's not quite addressed in Red Dawn.
So you have to acknowledge what kind of society we have. We don't have a society of farmers like the Boers who have a lot of experience in combat with the natives. We don't have a society like the Afghans, where you've got these kind of villagers who are brought up with firearms and with fighting. We're an urban society. So it seems to me we have to use our strengths, which is our ability to organize, to train each other, and perhaps draw the lines of defense in order to defend what's most important to us, which would be our population centers.
And that's what Western Europeans do. We are fundamentally a Western European nation, and that's what they've always done. And that's what the British did, and the British are a fine example. The problem is we can't prepare for this a day too late.
Well, just let's wind up with that thought. If you were advising the president, what steps could be taken to ensure that an invader could not successfully occupy the United States, what would be your top recommendations to him?
Well, the top recommendations were all of the above that I've mentioned already: organization, equipping, training. But the thing is that we as a nation have to understand, that the president has to understand, is it's better to prepare 50 years too early than prepare an hour late. Once the invasion started, it's too late. You can't make up for years of no organization. You can't make up for years of defense cuts. You can't make up for years of no training.
It's not too early to start working on this issue.
No, but there is a point where it becomes too late.
Well, thank you very much for this fascinating discussion, Marchand. You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about the principles of insurgency warfare and how the United States, in a hypothetical invasion, might fight an insurgency war against foreign occupiers. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. We thank you, listeners, very much for your generous contributions to WPKN, which keeps this community station independent and strong. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and at WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.